79.
Okay, what's your birth date?
5th of November, 1938. Okay. Just before the war.
Just before World War II. Yeah.
But with the Second World War, it wasn't my fault. Okay.
No one's blaming you, Ed. No one's blaming you. So I just want to kind of get a sense of what you remember and what it was like growing up, sort of from 1938 onwards. So you were in the middle of the Great Depression.
Of course, I was too little
to know what that was
about.
That
it was an awful thing that was happening. Yeah. To me, that was just the way the world was, that I could hear the bombers going overhead at night and, you know, saw the searchlights, and we had to have blackout. And
did you grow up in Melbourne?
No, I was in England. I came out here when I was 24.
Oh.
So we were in North Wales. My father was an electrical engineer, but when the Depression came and he couldn't get work, he got a job with Hoover, selling vacuum cleaners door to door, and he was very good at it.
Was he your kind of personality?
No, he's much more outgoing than me. And he was a real personality entertainer.
He had
a great singing voice. He used to play banjo, and he used to belt me often, but he was great. I loved him. He was so entertaining.
What was his name?
Arthur. And my mother played the piano, and she would play for him, and he would sing.
Oh, how wonderful. What was her name?
Marion.
Marion and Arthur.
And she died in 2006.
Gee, how old was she?
93.
Wow, well done.
But I was going over there every year to see her because her other son had died, and all her other relatives and most of her friends. And then she was in a nursing home, so I used to go over for 2 weeks a year and spend time with her.
So I guess that would have been the sort of off the back of the Depression. Many people, like your father, although he sounds like he might have had that lovely tendency to look on the bright side of things, but people weren't, you know, a lot of people wouldn't have been able to pursue what their passion was.
No. But of course,
you just needed a job.
You know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Mm.
And for a lot of people, all of a sudden, they had a purpose in life when the war was on, and
so that became the united purpose.
Knitting socks for the troops, and I know my mother and the lady across the way used to make shopping baskets out of raffia and milk bottle tops. And we were all saving pans that, instead of throwing them away, we'd take them and we'd donate books to go to the troops and things. And everybody was. They're on the same team.
Right.
And it was a good feeling. I mean, it's an awful thing that's happening. People were being killed right
up the course. Is that where that saying came from? It was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
It's from a Dickens novel.
Oh, okay. But was it referencing anything like what you're talking about? Because it's an interesting take on it that someone my age wouldn't have realised, that the positive sense of purpose, because people largely do like to be part of something bigger, and I guess generations that weren't living through that as children of, or, you know, or adults of, probably look back and think, oh God, it must have been just such a terribly depressing time because people were getting killed and death was, you know, and there was fear. But there's a lot of that, what you were talking about, people having a purpose and being able to have a united, what can we do? And this is my little patch of what I can do.
It was absolutely true. I mean, if you lived in the middle of London, it was pretty scary, but I was saying my father got moved around with Hoover and he got the option just before the war of moving us to North Wales, and he could see the writing on the wall, so we went to live in a place called Rhyl in North Wales.
Yeah.
So that's my first memories are there, living by the seaside.
How lovely.
And we didn't get bombed. I used to hear the bombers going over.
But you could see.
They would follow the coast up to Liverpool and Manchester.
Is that scary? What do you remember, sort of like how you felt when you would be hearing those planes go overhead?
Well, my father was, he wasn't a fighting man. He was seconded to doing electrical work on the Wellington bombers in Manchester. So he will be there Monday to Friday, and the weekends he will come down to Rill.
Mm.
And so I used to sleep with my mum all of the time in the big bed.
Mm.
And I know she was scared.
Yeah. How do you know she was scared? You just felt
she was just holding on to me very tightly.
Oh, I bet she was really
scared. And trying not to show that she was scared so that I wouldn't be scared.
Mm-hmm.
But it became such a regular thing, the drone of the bombers, and nothing happened to us. I mean, there was occasional a bomb was dropped, probably accidentally.
Yeah.
But there was nothing. Oh, well, the only thing that was interesting, I was in the pram one summer afternoon.
In the pram?
In the pram, out in the garden.
Jeez, you've got a long memory.
I can't remember this moment.
Oh, are you okay? I was going to say, wow.
I was, you know, under 12 months old.
Mm.
And she was talking to the next door neighbour, and suddenly a German plane came down the street at about 100 feet. A reconnaissance plane.
Wow.
With the swastika and the cross.
No, oh my God. Even the thought gives me fear, and I didn't even live through that.
Well, they just...
Oh,
you know,
God.
And immediately behind it came a Spitfire, and he was obviously driving it down to the nearest airport.
So you're going down.
Yeah.
You're getting out of that plane. You're on our turf.
These two planes just came down the street, you know, really low level. That was the nearest we got to the wall. And I remember the parties we had in the house.
Really?
In the dark a lot of this time.
With candles?
No, just
in the dark.
No, we just had...
Dancing in the dark.
A torch, and Mum would be on the piano, and we'd be doing songs, and I remember we had visitors, they'd be going around the house singing McNamara's band, you know, and they'd all have saucepans and spoons and...
Really?
And making a noise and walking in single file like a conga line around the house.
Really? All in the dark, and just really just being... joyful.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And was that, you know, like a whole lot of the neighbours?
No.
Just friends?
No, neighbours. We used to have quite often, because we were out of the bombing area, we had quite a lot of relatives. Most of our relatives were in the town called Bolton in Manchester, and that area was bombable. You know, that's where the bombers went, because that was where the industry was.
Oh, right. That's
and
target.
So we had relatives used to come and stay with us, and we also had people from London used to come and stay with us for a couple of weeks to get away from, you know, they paid. My mother cooked for them. They had their own bedroom and a lounge and so on. And but they had an opportunity to get away from the Blitz, you know, for a couple of weeks.
Gee.
So there's always people around.
And so that became like a way for your parents to make money, is to sort of almost become like a, you know, an Airbnb type of thing
and host
people.
I don't think she would have made a lot out of it.
No.
But yes, it was like a B&B sort of thing for her. And then my father was being paid for his work on the bombers. But,
What did he do on the bombers?
He was electrical wiring.
Right.
He was an electrical engineer.
Mm.
And I had parents who were loving, and I had a brother who used to drop me on my head and put a pillow over my face.
Oh, gosh.
He was 7 years older than me.
That sounds a little...
And I think he resented...
Serious.
...having been the sort of solitary child for 7 years.
And then along you come.
Interloper came along and was getting all this attention.
The young cute kid that's cutting his lunch. Wow.
But it's, you know, that was the world I was born in, and it didn't seem unusual to me.
No.
So that was how things worked.
So let's sort of jump, you know, towards what is known now as, like, you know, the age of the millennials, you know, in your mid to late 20s. What do you remember about yourself and where you were in that time then?
At 20?
Well, mid to late 20s, you know, when you're kind of young and planning a life and working towards it, and you've got goals and dreams and...
Yeah, that was... We went back to Bolton after the war, and so I had my secondary... Oh, primary and secondary schooling mainly there.
Mm.
And I went to Leeds University, and then I was working mostly in the Midlands for a big electrical company.
Mm.
And then at 24...
So you sort of followed in your dad's footsteps a little?
Yes, I wasn't really interested in electrical engineering, but I wasn't brilliant.
Mm.
And it was the only thing I could get to do at university. And
because of grades, or it just seemed like an easy path?
I had a good time when I was a teenager, and like a lot of teenagers, I got enough points to get through, but
yeah,
it was always very average. And that was the same at university, I had fairly average scores.
Mm.
And then I worked with this big electrical company who used to, they took on graduate apprentices. So if you had a degree, you could work for them for 2 years.
Yeah.
And they moved you around to electronic factories, and I worked on a nuclear power station and sales office in London and things like that. And they had people from Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa, from the Commonwealth countries doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And I just got to love the Australians.
Did you?
I thought they were terrific.
Well, we are.
They were so irreverent. They had such a sense of humour. They loved a good time.
Yeah.
And I had relatives in New South Wales as a result of the First World War, when an Australian soldier married my mother's sister.
Oh.
Took her back to Australia.
Yeah.
So they then bred like rabbits in New South Wales. And so when I came out, I had somewhere to go. So I worked for 6 months on a chicken farm and a sheep farm as a sort of jackaroo, which was fun.
How old were you then?
24.
Uh-huh.
And then I accidentally got a job with IBM, the computer company.
Oh, wow. And what were they doing back then?
Oh, well, it was...
Mid 40? Oh, no, what are we now? No.
Early 60s.
60s, yeah.
And they had the series called the 1400. But they were still selling these big cast iron machines that processed punch cards, you know, great big sorters and collators and accounting machines.
Ah.
And they were general purpose machines. So you had a panel, which was like a pegboard, and you put wires in to make the machine what you wanted to do. And I came out on the Oriana ship, which was lovely, and we were on the same table every night. There's about 10 people per table. And the girl next to me was a very attractive girl from London called Jill, and I made the decision not to make a play for her.
Not to marry her.
Well, because she was on the same table, I thought it could be embarrassing if it doesn't work out. So I found this New Zealand girl that I got associated with. But Jill and I got on famously. We used to dance a lot together. She was a good dancer.
Yeah.
And when I went up to Sydney for interviews for electrical engineering jobs, I stayed with her and her sister and brother-in-law.
Yeah.
And after the meal one night, he's got one of these boards and he's putting one. I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, this is for an accounting machine." He said...
The IBM.
If you read a punch card, the information comes through these holes, and you put a wire and you say where you want the stuff printed and so on, and this goes to the adding section. I said, "You get paid for doing that?" And he said, "Well, look, they're hiring at the moment." So the following day I went to IBM and knocked on the door and said,
"Hi,
I'm here.
Where's your punch machine?"
And they put me through all the aptitude tests and personality tests and 3 interviews, and they said, "I've got a job if you want." And I just loved it.
So when did you get married?
69.
Okay. And so how old were you when you got married?
30.
Okay. Was that quite late in the day for your generation to get married?
I wasn't in any hurry.
No? You weren't under pressure to...
I was having a good time.
Good.
I had 30 girlfriends between the age of 15 and 30. And that sounds appalling. it's only one every 6 months. You know.
Well, can I say it does sound appalling, actually, Ed. Just because we have this very, you know, my generation have, well, not all of us, but I certainly think, you know, you see all these lovely black and white movies.
I always used to think that marriages were simple affairs. Boy meets girl, fall in love, they get married. Have babies. Eventually the babies grow up and meet other babies. They fall in love, get married, and have babies, so on and on.
Now, I mean, people mature at different times. Normally it's about 25.
Mm.
There's a physical change happens to the body. You're sort of growing till you're 25 and then you start dying.
Yeah.
And you look at the accident statistics with motorists and they're up here somewhere for teenagers.
Yeah.
And they get to 25 and it's like a cliff face.
Yeah.
They suddenly drop off having accidents. So something happens to the brain.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen to my brain till I was 30.
Was so mid to late 20s, like was... Would you, what if someone sort of said to you, what was the one thing, the biggest thing that was occupying your mind? Was it women? I mean, what was the big thing?
Yeah, no, it wasn't the big thing. It was a group of things. I loved my job.
Yeah.
And that was a great satisfaction to me. And I loved going out with girls and... other friends and things too, but and sports, you know. Mm. I took up snow skiing when I came to Melbourne and used to play tennis and squash and got a little bit of soccer in at the start, but then it was very hard to get a game. But there were so many things, and then theatre. I got accidentally got into theatre. Read a Russian novel, the most incredible coincidence has happened in Russian novels. The girl on the ship, if she hadn't been sitting there,
Jill.
If I hadn't made friends, I would not have worked for IBM, I would not have moved to Melbourne. It was just that one little thing that happened in my life that completely changed the direction. And
the sliding door moment.
I was asked by a girl who I was friendly with, but not romantically.
Yeah.
And she was going to a 21st and she said, would you be my partner? It's a formal thing. And I said, yes, I'm happy to do that. Went along. This group of young people are standing around. They're all in the mid-20s saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? I said, what's the problem? They said, oh, we're doing a play. And it opens a week after next, and the guy who's playing one of the middling but important parts has dropped out, and we don't know what we're going to do. And I said, well, can I do it for you?
And they said, could I have that lead part?
They said, have you had any experience? And I said, oh, I did a bit at the local church and at school and things. And so I went along, and the director auditioned me.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, you'll be fine. So I did the play, which was the worst play I've ever been in. It was awful.
Why?
Oh, the quality of the thing was just...
Oh, I love the way you've barreled in with no experience and suddenly you're looking down your nose at it.
No.
You even, your intuition, your creative intuition, even if you didn't have the experience, then was saying, oh, no, this is crap.
No, I enjoyed doing it. But the lady that did it, she was 80 years old, the director. It was her last play. She didn't direct up to that. It got panned in the newspaper, but
so it was reasonably high profile if it's being picked up and written about in the newspaper.
Well, it was at the time. It was what did he call it? Listener in, and there was a page for amateur theatre. So there's a guy called Laurie Landry used to review all the amateur shows, and but this woman had been a professional actress, and she was well known amongst the theatrical community in Melbourne. So a lot of people came to see the play.
Oh, wow.
And after the play, two people approached me, a guy who was a director from Brighton Theatre and a lady who was a director from Toorak Players.
Yeah.
They both came up to me and introduced themselves. And they said, frankly, Ed, it was not a good production, but we did like your performance.
Well, we thought you were good.
Would you come and audition
for
us for our next play? And all of a sudden, it was on for one and all, you know.
Jeez, that's a fast track finding your purpose, isn't it?
So much joy out of doing theatre over the years.
Your positive way of looking at everything, and you said you loved your IBM job, you were grateful and enjoyed the electrical stuff. What I think is interesting between different generations these days is... very much, which is different to your generation growing up, is this generation are all about pretty much, I only want to work in my ultimate joy, you know. There's, of course there are, a lot of them that maybe a bit more old-fashioned and want to get married, and therefore it's really about bringing in an income. But largely, you know, the millennials have this very luxurious place of exploring themselves and through social media finding their tribes, and very instantly they can connect with, wow, that brings me joy, I'm genuinely interested in that. And once you are, that's a free-flowing thing. It sort of, it kind of happens.
Yeah.
How did that sort of feel when you're suddenly like, you know, you've just had that piece of the puzzle connected in and it's like, you're good at this? You know, how does that feel thinking, okay, this could be where I'm going?
It seems to me that if people have a lot of different things in their life, they're going to be a lot happier, because if one falls over, they've got other things that they can do. So if they're into sport, or if they're into music, or theatre, or painting, or whatever it is, they've got different things that give them pleasure. And if, you know, they've broken up with a spouse or something, they can concentrate on the other areas of life. But there's a wonderful play, I can never pronounce the author's name, he's a Czechoslovak guy, and he wrote a play. He was the man who invented the term robot. And he wrote a play called, it's sometimes called the Insect Play, or And So Ad Infinitum. And there's a drunk, and he's in the park, and he's having these dreams. And they're all different insects. And the play is about these different sorts of insects and the way they approach life. So there's the dung beetle. And the dung beetle has got his little pile of dung that he rolls around with him. He's scared people are going to take it off him. And that's all he has in his life. This is the sort of person. Then there was these people who just like to flirt. True. You know, they have lots of relationships and they don't commit themselves to anybody. It's all party, party time. Let's have some drugs. And, you know.
I know a few of those.
And then there's an insect that just lives for its child. And goes around killing other insects to feed the child. You know, just lives for the child. And so there's all these different things.
I love it. It's painting such a picture of actual people that I know and you know.
That's right. You suddenly think, oh, I know people like that.
Yeah, that's where they've slotted into.
And at the end of the play, the drunk says, I think I've learned about life now. But suddenly death appears from the other side of the stage and says, I'm sorry, but it's your time to go. Oh, but I've just learned how to live.
Oh,
I'm sorry, he says, and takes him off.
It's too late.
It's a great play, though. It's a great play. But isn't that true, that you have people who just concentrate on one little thing?
Yes. Well, it's that real putting all your eggs in one basket, which is dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so you've always sort of had a sense that that's not the way, you know, compartmentalise your joys and your ambitions, you know, and have a few things on the go.
Yeah. No, I've lost things. I mean, I was doing painting and I really enjoyed doing painting. I was quite good at it.
Yeah.
But as the site deteriorated, I just had to move away.
Yeah.
So I can't do that anymore. So that's...
That one's off the table.
Directing children is gone.
What is it like when you get to an age where something like, you know, either gradual or quite immediate, where, you know, suddenly you've lost 90% of your hearing and you know that's not coming back? How does that feel?
It's quite awful. I mean, I've lost my sight over 5 years.
Yeah.
I'm not happy about that.
No.
But that's not as bad as losing your hearing.
Really?
Because the most important thing in your life, you find, when you get to this stage, is that people are the most important thing. And if you can't communicate with people, you know, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
I mean,
because you're really losing connection with people.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just love going out for coffee with somebody and chatting and so on. And, I mean, if I go to a restaurant now, it's busy. Yeah. I have trouble following the conversation with all the noise. But in a quiet, that's why here, if you go to the dining room here, they've got a little semi-private room at the end. And if I'm having people lunch, I arrange for it to be in there.
Yeah, so you can hear where the audio is best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm very sensitive to background noise.
Yeah.
But, yeah, don't lose your hearing. I've lost a lot of the richness in my life, the things that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
I can't see to play the piano properly without that. Great joy in my life was has been with children's theatre.
Yes.
Which I've done for 40 years.
Mm.
And because of my sight, I can't direct anymore because I can't see the kids.
Yeah.
And I can't see their expressions or their gestures or how they're moving.
So you gave that up last year? You had to give that up?
I'm still involved with it.
Yeah.
But all I do now, I play the keyboard.
And you can still do that through your feeling your way. I can
do that with feeling.
Yeah.
But I can't. So I've got a grand piano in my flat.
Yeah.
I had a whole lot of music, big shelves with music.
Yeah.
And I've given it all away because I can't see it.
Aww.
And mostly classical stuff. And I'm not good at remembering classical stuff, but I was all right if I had the music.
Yeah.
So I'm restricted to playing down here somewhere because I can't suddenly go Puklong up there or Puklong down there.
Mm.
But I can still play, but not to be able to direct the kids and see how they're performing.
Yeah, of course.
To see them when they're actually on stage with an audience.
Yeah.
And see their faces, and their eyes are like saucers, you know.
Mm.
It's such a magic experience for them.
Mm.
And I do miss that. It's funny, Amber, as you lose these things,
yeah,
but you suddenly recognise the importance of other things and you
do
change
you?
Your priorities. And I suddenly became aware, with the loss of my sight and hearing, that the most important thing in my life was people. If I had friends,
yeah,
I've got relatives, of course, but friends and relatives, just the interaction with people,
yeah,
is the most important thing.
Yeah.
You're probably aware, a lot of people, they get to retire and they lose their spouse. One of the partners dies, and a lot of people are just on their own in their house.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I'm here.
Did you lose your partner?
Yes, I lost in 2013.
Yeah.
And we've been married for 44 years.
Wow.
We were still in love and
we were
just very good friends.
What was her name?
Maureen. Give a score to things that happen in your life. So you lose your job, or you lose a pet, or you lose your spouse, or there's a house fire, and they give scores to these things.
Yeah.
If you get up to 100, you should be seeing your doctor once a month because you're in a dangerous position there.
Your heart's in a dangerous position,
yeah.
Literally.
But I think a spouse is 50. The loss of a spouse is 50 points. That's half.
Which is
the whole thing.
A lot. And that's half your credit gone.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I was losing my sight. I lost my wife.
Oh, my God.
It was all happening at the same time. I couldn't drive. So to visit my wife, she was in hospital for 5 months.
And what was wrong with her?
She had trouble with her esophagus, and I don't know whether that triggered something, but then she had trouble with her other organs.
Mm.
And... she was in Cabrini, so I had to get trams, to Cabrini.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't drive. And then she went to St. George's in Kew, which was walking distance for me. That was good. And I saw her every day for 112 days while she was in the hospital.
Gee.
But she was going in and out of sort of comas, and also... The organs were not getting rid of the toxins, so she was talking nonsense at times. She knew who I was, but they would ask her things like, what year is it? And she'd say, oh, 1975.
Yeah.
it was still her, so I just clung on to what was there. It wasn't a happy time.
How have you been since? Like, how's the progress of recovery for you?
I don't suffer from depression, so I'm lucky.
No, you seem to be someone that's pretty...
I've got friends who've got depression. It's the most awful thing. No, I'm lucky in that I've got some really good friends.
That's so good. Oh, well, it doesn't surprise me, though. I've not known you that long. It doesn't surprise me, but it's so important, isn't it? Because they're the family you choose.
Yeah. And as I say, I've got my talking books, which are absolute joy.
I love them.
I mean, I read about 5 books a week. And
oh, wonderful.
I really love that. And now I've got my computer, which has given me another bit of richness in my life.
That's right.
Doing my life story, that's one of the things I'm doing.
Are you? How wonderful.
Not for publication, but just out of interest and something for my kids.
For your children, yes.
And I'm still writing stuff for children's theatre. So I'm writing a play. I've written about 10. And I've got another one on the go at the moment. And I'm also, the play we're doing this year with my group is based on Don Quixote.
Oh, yes.
And I haven't written it. A young lady, she's 30, has written.
That's young.
She's written the script, mm-hmm. and I'm doing the songs. So there's 10 songs in the play.
Yeah.
And so I've had lots of fun writing the music and the lyrics.
Oh, how wonderful.
And
you do that with your talking computer?
Yeah, you see, yeah. I was composing lyrics, but I had no way of writing
them. You're putting them down.
And so it's really awkward. But as soon as I got to the stage where the computer was operating, I could dictate my lyrics and then it would read back and then I could alter and fix up and things. Mm-hmm. So that's been a lot of fun. The way I got together with my wife was an interesting story.
Oh!
Oh, this gorgeous young 5-foot-nothing blonde girl was going out with my housemate and that was it. And then one day, I was returning to the office in St Kilda from the city, working with IBM, and she was accidentally coming out of the building as I was going in. And I said, oh, hello, Maureen, how are you? And I knew she did amateur theatre, and I said, what are you up to? And she said, oh, I'm doing stuff with 1812, Ferntree Gully, but I'm sick of driving up there. And I said, oh, well, Brighton Theatre Company are auditioning for Arsenic and Old Lace next week, you know, why don't you go along? And so, cut a long story short, she got into the play and I got into the play. We got cast as romantic leads.
Oh, wow.
Basically. And we were both good actors. And we got in, the director saying, I love what you're doing. He said, but we open tomorrow. This is the final dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
And we haven't had the kiss. You know, we have to run across the stage into each other's arms because we haven't seen each other for about a month.
Yeah.
And he said, that's the kiss scene. Can we please do that now? Mm. Oh, no worries. We said, yeah, we're professionals, you know. So, okay, go. So we got the cue. She ran over. I ran over in the middle of the stage. Went to this kiss. It is so corny. You know the thing where bells ring and birds sing?
And squirrels in tuxedos dance around your feet?
I couldn't believe it. I was just knocked off my feet.
No.
And the director said,
the fireworks.
That was really good, kids, but carry on with the script. I couldn't remember the next line.
Oh, my
God. He said, well, go back, do it again, and then carry on. We did it 3 times, and I couldn't remember. And I thought, the next line is, I have to go down to the office, or, you know. And eventually, I had to write it on my hand, and there's the audience. So
because you'd lost the plot.
We come out of the kiss, and have a look at what the next line was.
Oh, my gosh. And you obviously talked about it later. Was she having the same...
No,
blown over.
Through the rehearsal period, she lived near me, and so I was picking her up, taking her to rehearsal and home, and she'd usually have a coffee at my place and then drive home.
Yeah.
But it was all very platonic.
Yeah.
But I think she was getting quite interested before I was.
So did you think when you had that kiss, did you think, oh, God, what's happening here? Was it, like, scary or what was it? Because you'd probably...
I mean, it was a platonic relationship. She was a very good-looking woman. But she was 6 years younger than me, so she was, or whatever it was, 23.
Yeah.
But I thought we were just friends, you know. And
what's this crazy
feeling?
All of a sudden,
the world changed, you know.
Yeah.
Like the Wizard of Oz going from black and white to colour. It's a very corny story.
It's so beautiful. Did you in that moment kind of think, oh gosh, this is a something?
Well, I knew something had happened.
Yeah.
But we went out for nearly 2 years before we got married.
Yeah.
We were very, possibly because we'd been friends, we got over that. You know, you fall in love.
Yeah.
It's the chemistry that's happening. It's the hormones, you know.
Yes.
And often 2 years is about as long as it lasts. And we got through that. And so we were really good friends when we got married.
You were solid.
And we took that on through our married life.
How beautiful.
It's with utmost respect I am interrupting this beautiful conversation now for a moment to thank my sponsors, Freedom Aged Care. So when I decided to do this podcast series, which really came from a genuine place of feeling like the one generation in our society being talked about the least was actually the one we needed to be listening to because these people have lived so much. So I decided to give an aged care company a go, and I chose one that I'd explored during my search to find somewhere for my dad to live. And I instantly loved what Freedom appeared to be about, which was celebrating the lives of their residents, but doing it with a really joyful touch. And I contacted a guy called Craig Flett, who's one of the family members involved with Freedom Aged Care, a guy I'd never met. And in an email, I poured my heart out on why I wanted to do this series. And to my great surprise, he instantly said he wanted to get on board. As he put it, Freedom's residents have together lived a million years of life, a fact that the company is really intensely proud of. So it's become a really beautiful, authentic union, and it's allowed me to get paid for what I love doing, and for them, hopefully it highlights their commitment to honouring the people who have led long, brave and interesting lives, and people who deserve not to be forgotten. So now, back to my wonderful guest.
I mean, we're getting to sort of the end of our time together, which is a shame because I haven't eaten the two other biscuits in the whatever the chocolate brownies. I might get a doggy bag, you know. But I just wondered, and I've enjoyed hearing your story so much, and just your attitude reminds me of overarching thread of what I picked up from when I did a podcast series with the Australian Ballet. And I really came away from that just really conscious that they all have such a positive filter that they put all their thoughts and decisions through. And it made me realize that mine's not always like that. And I know a lot of other people just that they don't naturally put everything through a consistently sort of positive filter, and that I think that's a wonderful thing for me and other people to learn. Is there anything that you've, you know, when you look back on your life, is there anything that you go, you know what, I wish I'd cared less about that. I just didn't need to care so much about that crap.
I can't think of anything. No, I think I would have dropped it if...
Yeah, it sounds like you're savvy enough to go, you're just not going to stay in it.
I haven't lived a life of crime. I didn't get into that. No, all the sport I've done, I've enjoyed the people I've met. I mean, obviously you meet people that you prefer not to see again from time to time.
Of course.
But I say to people, I like everybody. Everybody's got a reason for being who they are.
Yeah.
And it's finding out what makes them tick. And they may be objectionable.
Yeah.
But there's really something's happened in their life perhaps to make
it. This is probably a stupid question given the way you've led your life by the sounds of things, but is there anything you wish you'd put a little more time into? I mean, not that your time is over, but is there anything you look back and think, oh, I wish I'd just done that a bit more? I wish I'd given more time to it.
Yeah, no, I could probably have started my painting a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I only started about, I think it was about 6 years ago or something. Mm. I only painted for 2 years before my sight precluded me from going on with it. And I sort of thought, yeah, I wish I'd done that.
Was painting something that you'd sort of thought about during the course of your life and felt you wanted to do?
It was mainly landscapes, but also Australian birds. I had a book of, lovely big book of birds, and so it was basically copied, but, you know, there'd be a pelican or something.
Yeah.
And I would paint that. And then I used to paint landscapes from photographs that I'd taken of places that I liked, and I just got a lot of, I wasn't brilliant.
Yeah.
I sold one painting.
Yeah.
A friend of mine has a gallery in Kew, and he said, we're doing a charity thing. Have you got any paintings you want to donate? And I said, I'll give you half a dozen.
So is that all?
Somebody bought a painting of a yellow robin that I done.
Oh, how wonderful.
$50, which that's the only...
Well, you know what? That has reminded me... in conclusion, and I reckon probably anyone that listens to this will probably be thinking the same, but Thank you.
I'd like to thank Freedom Aged Care for introducing me to some of its wonderful residents for this series, who together have lived a million years of life. To find out more about Freedom Aged Care, head to freedomagedcare.com.au.